Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Chris Lord. On the show today, I'll be joined in the studio by art advisor and art dealer Kathleen Fox-Davies and co-founder of Unbound Publishing, John Mitchinson. Together, we'll be discussing a couple of May's book releases and the weekend's biggest art event here in London, Photo London. Plus, we'll hear from podcast reviewer Pete Norton about the shows to download for your commute this week, and we'll meet the people behind a new film called The Journey to find out why sometimes it takes more than some famous faces and big-name producers to get your movie distributed. We'll also be running through the Portuguese music charts to find out whether their Eurovision winner, Salvador Sobral, managed to take the number one spot as well as the trophy this week. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. I'm joined in the studio by Kathleen Fox-Davies and John Mitchinson. Welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much for dropping by at Midori House today. John, we're going to hear from you a little bit later on about the books you've been reading this week and this month in the show, but I want to kick things off with Photo London. Now, this is a huge photography fair and fairly young one at that. It's been its third edition now here in London, taking place at Somerset House this weekend. Kathleen, you nipped down to the preview, I believe, last night.
Yes.
How is it getting on?
It is a fantastic show this year. I think they've really built strength on strength. The third year is definitely the strongest with the galleries they've chosen, the programming, the more academic exhibitions they have that's a part of this entire fair. What's amazing about Photo London is London has an incredibly vibrant and rich photography market. Lots of collectors here, lots of people come from all over the world to see the London galleries. So you walk around wanting to see the big names that we know that I've probably been on to talking about on other arts reviews. So I really would like to skim over those because they were all amazing. But what I want to focus on are the ones that were sort of the new discoveries for me.
These emerging talents.
They're emerging talents. They're galleries that are from locations that I've never actually been to go see their brick and mortar space. A lot of the galleries that are showing, I'd say a good handful, don't actually have a formal exhibition space. They're more of a pop-up based program, which is a really cool idea and how the art market in general is changing as a younger guard is coming in and starting up their own projects and their own programs. And you see Photo London supporting all of these, the institution of photography, of the commercial gallery, of bringing in all of the photo auctions are this week. I think as we speak, Phillips is auctioning some amazing pieces off. Sotheby's is tomorrow. Christie's is this week as well. And all of that's come together on all levels, really to celebrate everything the medium has to offer. It's just fantastic.
Brilliant. Tell us a little bit about some of those highlights, because I'd love to hear from this sort of more emerging side, these sort of slightly less lesser known people that you've discovered. What have you found there, Kathleen?
Photo London has a section called Discovery, where the galleries there, they're allowed a small exhibition space. They're sort of in this sort of funny, cavernous hallway of Somerset House. The entire fair is set up in this labyrinth, so you could spend days there and never retrace your steps just by accident or on purpose. So there's an amazing sense of discovery. But you get down to this section that was really well curated this year. The first thing that I saw was Liz Nielsen, who is a Brooklyn-based artist. It's her very first exhibition here in London, and it's the first time her gallery has shown at Photo London. So there were a lot of debuts happening, but the work is incredible. You will stop. You will want to ask questions. She calls herself an experimental photographer, but she's really returning to the foundations of analog photography and exploring the limitations and the boundaries of the chemical process of color photo processing. So she's making photograms in a darkroom setting and using layering of almost puzzle pieces of different color films, creating her own negatives. Some of them are huge, large scale. So there's an interactive of her negotiating in the pitch black, making these incredibly, they're very well thought out. They're determined. She goes in with a plan and she comes out with these works that are painterly. They're beautiful. They are saturated in color. It's a process where in order to make white, you have to add all of the light and all of the colors, and the black is what has been kept away. So there's a complete reverse in thinking.
Yeah, it's not just about content, essentially.
No.
It's not just about what you are imaging. It's actually the physicality of film and of a photograph
as
well.
It's her interacting with her own materials. And it's been a process of experimentation as she's got to this point of work that is showing here. I was exposed slightly to her at Perifoto, but re-reminded and never seen this many pieces all at once. And they are phenomenal. She's showing with Next Level Gallery, that is Paris-based.
Interesting. Just on the subject of physicality, I think one thing that a lot of listeners will be interested in is, you know, when we talk about an art fair these days, one of the things that people always often say about art fairs is, look, you know, you've got this incredible installation, works brilliantly in an amazingly curated gallery space or a museum space, but then suddenly you're taking that and putting it into a fair scenario where people are buying and selling,
which
almost
incredibly in the commercial and sometimes a little bit crass.
That's right. How does it work when photography goes into a space like that?
Well, it's a very different way of interacting with the pieces on the wall. It is a highly commercial setting. The galleries are bringing the work for the purpose of exposure of the artist, but also for sales. That's why they're there, and to meet clients and collectors and be exposed to major institution representatives. And that's really what these fairs are about. There are two ways of looking at this. What Photo London has gone purposely and as part of their process in selecting galleries is they've insisted that the galleries bring artwork that is new, that is something that's put together in a new way of looking and thinking, so that you're not just seeing the same stock that the gallery totes out for every art fair. So you are seeing things that are different, which is what's so amazing. Even with the London-based galleries, they're artists that I never would have associated with the work. You've got Michael Hoppen, which has taken a completely tongue-in-cheek look at what's happening in our political and social environment and has the Brexit wall. And so it's it's amazing. It's a huge salon hang of sort of the best of British photographers and also international photographers looking at London life and you know, the multi-layers of the contributions that have been added there. But it's to great effect.
So there is a curated feel.
That's very But looking at another gallery that has taken a completely different approach to an art fair, it's the Louise Alexander Gallery, who's based out of Italy, and they have put on a solo Guy Bourdin show. And Guy Bourdin's known for his heavily saturated, really sexy, sensual fashion photographs. He mainly published in Vogue from sort of the 1950s onwards, but he really redefined how we think and look at fashion photography and paved the way for an entire new generation of contemporary photographers as well.
That sounds fantastic. Yeah.
What they've done is they represent the Guy Bourdin estate. So they have taken photographs from 1952-53, I believe, the vintage pieces, the tiny Polaroids, the black and whites, all the way through to the later work that we know and love and that you see everywhere and you see in every auction and in the history books and in the fashion magazines. But they're exposing a new way of looking at this artist. Half of the work is not for sale.
Interesting.
Period. Wow. It's just there to add to the content of the narrative of what they're trying to say.
I suppose nowadays, you know, there's a lot of pressure on gallerists when they participate in fairs like this to make sure that they're still creating something that's noteworthy,
that stands out
and is, as you mentioned, a curated show that brings something to the discourse around this work. Basically.
It's amazing, but as a collector and as an individual that buys for collectors, it's incredibly frustrating when you see something that's amazing, you fall in love with it, and they say, well, unless you're a major institution, probably not going to happen.
Absolutely. I just want to ask you just one thing, Kathleen. Obviously, this year is a very important year for Magnum, obviously the world-famous photography agency, some of the biggest names in the world of photography, with, of course, at its apex, Martin Parr being the head of the organisation these days. How's that being felt at Photo London this year?
Well, they've got the big exhibition, which sadly and embarrassingly I've not been to see yet. I've spent 2 days at the fair and I've not been down to the embankment level to actually see some of the bigger programs that they've put on. But you do see a lot of the gallerists responding by making sure that they have artists included in their own showings.
Mm. Sure. Yeah. So they're being felt in that way. They're sort of the galleries themselves are sort of obviously bringing out some of their Magnum photographers for the occasion, basically.
There is one other gallery I'd really like to talk about. I had walked through for 2 days. I thought I'd found the pieces that were going to be what I brought here and talked about. And then I stumbled upon East Wing Gallery, which is a Dubai-based gallery. And they're showing work by a Swiss-based artistic duo called Cortis and Sonderegger. They are recreating in their studio their large-scale color contemporary photographs. So just that's how you encounter them. They're huge. But they're recreating in their studio some of the world's most iconic images and historical moments. So you walk in and you're seeing Henri Cartier-Bresson's decisive moment, but you're not. You're seeing the last photograph of the Titanic at sea, but you're not. You're seeing Jacques-Henri Lattigue, Man Ray, Robert Capa, but they're recreating these images using no photographic material. It's cotton wool, it's plywood. They're absolutely fantastic scale model recreations. And when they actually take the picture, they stand back from the frame, so you see the workings of their studio and the materials at use, and you get an idea of scale and the chaos. But they're bringing into question this idea of what we perceive as reality, because these photographs have defined what we think of as historical moments and what we think of as our own histories. And they're taking that, turning it on its head, and making you question what they actually mean, and can they be looked at in another way? And perhaps our own memories are also, in the same way, can be re-looked at.
Absolutely. I'm playing with the canon of photography as well, these greats from the from the history of photography. Kathleen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I ask, what gallery was that showing?
Sorry.
Do you want to check it out?
That was at East Wing Gallery,
based
out of Dubai.
Ah, yes, in Dubai. I actually know those guys quite well. Photo London is on at Somerset House until the end of the weekend. Kathleen Fox-Davies, thank you very much
for
your review. Now, before we hear from John Mitchinson about his book selection for May, we're going to go to our regular podcast expert to find out what we should and possibly shouldn't be tuning into this week. Pete Norton is a podcast reviewer for various esteemed titles, and he speaks now to Holly Fisher.
Pete, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start with the BBC today, who are starting to wander into the realm of podcasts. And I want to start by talking about Fortunately. Why don't you tell us a bit about what that is?
So this launched about a month ago, and it's Fi Glover, I should say, and Jane Garvey. Basically, they kind of sit down, usually in a sort of canteen environment. They've got this lots of kind of tinkly background noise, and have an informal conversation, or at least an in quotation marks informal conversation, about a few things that they've enjoyed on BBC Radio in the past week. So it's kind of like a listening recommendation programme. But one thing that's interesting about it is that it's made for podcast only. And the BBC have been podcasting for a long time. They're one of the first major broadcast operations to actually start putting shows out as podcasts. I think In Our Time started in 2004 doing that, which was really the early days of the medium. But up until now, all of the stuff that the BBC put out has been broadcast first. It's been made for broadcast, and they've just put out as a podcast as well. Whereas this is specifically a podcast, and it's not being put out on the air. So I'm kind of glad to see that they're a bit late to that game, and I think they should have been doing this stuff much earlier. But I'm glad to see that they're taking note of it now as a medium in its own right. And I think with this show, it's more successful than there's another something that the BBC have just launched, which is less successful in the podcasting medium. This show, they've kind of got at least a sense of making something that's different, as opposed to just doing a Radio 4 style show and just putting it out. So it's got the informality. It feels like more like a conversation between friends, which is a kind of classic podcast trope, that it's less formal than the radio environment.
But I guess they're still using content from those Radio 4 shows that everyone knows and loves, because it is kind of like a, what have you been listening to this week? These were the highlights of Radio 4 this week. It's still kind of baby steps into the podcasting world. Why do you think they decided to do this rather than, you know, launch into something completely different to what they've got on air at the moment?
I mean, just the ecosystem that BBC is so broadcast. That's their world and that's what they understand. And I think it'll take a long time for the corporation to come round to the idea that this is actually an exciting medium. I'd imagine there was a lot of battles and executive meetings just to get this on going. I mean, I've heard informally from people inside the BBC that there's a lot of high up people don't understand podcasting or don't really even know what it is. Which I think is a sadness, because if you look at what some of the American broadcasters are doing, who are alive to the possibilities of this medium and the fact that it can grow their audience and provide a sort of sandpit for interesting ideas that might not necessarily get commissioned on a radio station. So NPR do some great podcast content, and they're really, and you know, the Americans are ahead of us here. And I think looking downstream, it could present some kind of a threat to the BBC if podcasting fulfills its potential and becomes a really global audio medium and can compete with broadcast radio, that's some years off, but it could happen. The BBC don't get in on that now. It could be a threat to them.
Well, let's talk about the other podcast they've just started, which is called Quake. Now, this is a little bit less straightforward than Fortunately.
Yes, so this launched yesterday, and it's a 12-part drama. Each part is about 5 to 10 minutes long. It's set in the aftermath of an earthquake on a fictional Pacific island called Shimao. And each episode follows a different character as they either are involved in the rescue effort or are trapped underneath the rubble. So you've got a bunch of different people around the world as well. Part of the focus of this series is the emergence of a kind of digital infrastructure that can help with disaster relief. So people who are crowdsourcing, there are people in Australia, there's a woman in Australia who's a character who's joining a global effort to sift through Twitter messages of people trapped in the rubble and create a map. And there's a drone pilot who's piloting a drone through a cloud of gas. So it's all quite sort of forward-looking. Unfortunately, it's heavy with ideas, but the drama itself falls clunkily flat. It's very high on expositionary dialogue. It doesn't have much atmosphere that gets you kind of gripped. It all feels like the ideas have come first and the drama has been a sort of afterthought.
I mean, and it's not just a podcast either as well. You've got the VR experience, you've got illustrations and videos. Tell us how it's sort of all set up on the website, because I did go and have a look at it and I was a little bit confused.
Yeah, there's quite a lot going on. It feels like they've got a various sort of experimental projects and they kind of baked it all into this one thing. All the episodes are available just as an audio podcast, which is, I think that's the best way of listening to it, actually. The first episode is available as a VR experience. So if you're one of the few people in the UK who's got a VR headset, you can kind of have this 360-degree... The episode's set. It follows a man who's in a bar as the earthquake hits, and the VR experience is the bar collapsing around him, and you can kind of look around. I've looked at it, and it didn't sort of blow me away. But all the episodes are also accompanied by, if you want, by these sort of... They're a bit like graphic novel illustrations, so they're slowly moving backgrounds, which are quite artfully done, but they don't add anything to the drama. I did watch through a bunch of those, and I found myself closing my eyes because it was interfering with my imagination of the scene. Like, it didn't, you know, it's a radio piece. I want my imagination to do the work, not an artist.
So they've almost kind of thrown too many things at this.
I think so.
Okay, so fortunately, Tick, but Quake, maybe give that one a miss.
Yes.
Okay, well, it'll be interesting to see what the BBC do next anyway.
Yeah, I hope they're going to do more experimental stuff, and I'm not knocking them for trying, but yeah, keep trying.
Okay, well, let's move on to something else now. This is from Cambridge University, and it's called Talking Politics. Set this one up for us, Pete.
So, perhaps unsurprisingly, political-flavoured podcasts are having a bit of a moment in 2017, 2016, 2017, and there's a whole bunch of them out there. So there's specific issue podcasts. There's one called Trumpcast, which follows the daily sort of events in Donald Trump land. There's a few Trump-themed ones, actually. There's many of the UK's biggest newspapers are doing political podcasts now. The FT are doing one, The Guardian, The Telegraph. So there's a lot of noise out there. And this podcast, for me, just cuts through it. It's made in Cambridge University's Department of Politics. It's presented by a guy called David Runciman, who's a professor there. It avoids being dustily academic. It just has this measured, balanced perspective on... It's every Thursday, so it's kind of usually the biggest political events in the last week that they discuss. And it just, I'm always looking forward to it arriving on a Thursday and kind of providing some sense of perspective to what the hell is going on this week. They're not fixated solely on Brexit and Trump. They have quite a nice international perspective that they've spoken recently about elections in India, in Turkey, in France. They have many interesting guests on. They had Thomas Piketty recently. They've had Michael Gove came on, Mary Beard, Rory Bremner. So they've got people from kind of both sides of the aisle. And it's just a breath of fresh air. Like I say, it's not, you might expect it to be rather academic and specialist, but they have a sense of a broad audience here.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that because I think a lot of people would be put off by a podcast of people from Cambridge University political department talking about politics. How do they manage to keep it accessible for anyone who wants to listen?
I don't know how they've managed. It's kind of a turn up for the books that they have, because you can imagine, you know, it would...
You could fall down a bit of a trapdoor of just going into lots of political history and, you know, all sorts of things that people don't really have a clue about.
Yeah, and going into your own specialist subject area. But I think partly it's the host. David Runciman is he's clearly a very talented public speaker, and he has a good sense of his audience and of marshalling his guests around an idea, keeping the thing moving. But it really is, I'm not a political expert at all, and it's not my speciality, and I can follow this every week, and it feels like a lot of the news cycle stuff is kind of it's so hysterical and concentrating on chaos of events and everything, and these guys just have a sense of stepping back and a historical perspective, that seeing echoes and where events are rhyming with other events across the decades, and I find that kind of calming.
I did have a listen to this, and it was interesting. At the top of the latest episode, they talk about how, you know, this has just happened in America, but we're not going to talk about that right now because we want to see how that plays out over the next 24 hours and we don't just want to jump in on it and tear it all apart. I think maybe part of its success is that there is that sort of measured thoughtfulness about it, and, you know, we're going to think about what we want to talk about, and we don't just want to shout and get our voices heard on this subject.
Exactly. And I mean, if you want that, there's plenty of coverage of that type everywhere. So this does feel like a nice counterpoint.
They have all sorts of guests on. I mean, they had the politician Michael Gove, and they also have authors and comedians like Rory Bremner and John Lanchester. Does that provide a little bit of levity to the subjects they're talking about?
Definitely.
Too?
And there is a wittiness to it as well. I should have mentioned that. It often brings out a wry smile. And their interviews have been very good. Yeah, John Lanchester was excellent. He writes in the LRB a lot about money and big finance and politics. Rory Bremner was very funny as well, as you can imagine. So it feels it's quite a cosmopolitan and mixed bag in the show. I mean, the only thing that I find is like it can't come soon enough. It feels like a long time between the Thursdays at the moment.
Pete Norton there, speaking to Monocle's Holly Fisher. You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Chris Lord. And I'm in the studio with art dealer and advisor Kathleen Fox-Davies and co-founder of Unbound Publishers, John Mitchinson, who we turn to now for this week's book review. John, we're going to be discussing the debut novel by Megan Hunter, The End We Start From, and as well as that, the new memoir by Richard Ford, between them a little bit later on. Actually, let's start with that menu, which is all about the Pulitzer Prize-winning author's parents. John, do you know a little bit about what prompted Ford to write this book now?
I think it's been a kind of a project. He wrote, it's two memoirs, one of his mother and one of his father. The one about his mother was written in 1981, which was the year he wrote the novel The Sports Writer, which was the book that really brought him to the kind of the attention, I think, of worldwide attention as a sort of the one of the great contemporary American novelists. And then the memoir of his father is the one that he's written now. He's now 73, and as he writes in the book, he's now older than both his parents.
Right.
His father died when he was 17, and the account of his father's life ends with a very moving section about his father's death. He woke up and died of a heart attack one morning. I guess the motivation for writing it is that he's been worrying away at family relationships and the gaps between parents and children through all his fiction. And I think there is also a part of what he says in a beautiful epilogue to the book is that, I mean, he wanted to preserve the sense that I think we all have of family memories, that if he didn't write these things down, they would disappear forever. Mm. It's an act of memory, of restoration, but it's also, being Richard Ford, it's an attempt to understand. And he worries and kind of finds all kinds of oblique angles. He's continually trying to capture the truth of the moments, the things that define, you know, his memories. He also writes about it as a rather sweet experience of the he remembered, the act of writing brought forth memories that he didn't realise he had. So,
and I suppose as well, you know, when we talk about the form of an elegy, you know, even if it's spun out across a whole book, let's say, of a prolonged elegy almost. You know, it's an interesting form, isn't it? One of the oldest forms of writing is an elegy as well. And sort of, I wonder how Ford plays with that a little bit. Does he sort of interrogate this form of the elegy?
I think he's always, I mean, he interrogates, Richard's style of writing is he writes the most long and complex, mellifluous, psychologically acute kind of sentences. And indeed, all the things that you love, I mean, his famous character, Frank Bascom, it's a first-person narrator, you know, meandering through the streets of New Jersey selling real estate. And it's not much happens. You know, if you try and boil down a Richard Ford novel, you know, Independence Day, the one that won the Pulitzer, you know, it's like a weekend with his son. Son gets injured in a baseball arcade.
In that very taut American way, almost.
That's pretty much it. Mm. But it's this incredibly rich, mellifluous, as I say, almost baroque in the detail. And you get a lot of that here, the portraits of his parents, physical portraits. He has an amazing way of summing up a kind of... He doesn't come to glib conclusions. And I think there's a lovely thing that he writes towards the end of the book where he says, writing these two remembrances indeed has been a source of immense exhilaration for me, quite different from what I would have expected given the longing I often experience. I was fortunate to have parents who loved each other, and out of the crucible of that great, almost unfathomable love, loved me. Love, as always, confers beauties. And I kind of think that's...
Trying to make sense of it almost, trying to understand through the writing.
But also through the precision of his language. Mm. It's a book about the relationship between parents and children and how parents define, to some degree or other, he was defined by those experiences. And yet, strangely, he says elsewhere that the most of what was important in their lives passed between them, which is where the title comes from, that he was in some ways excluded from, and he's almost, it's almost a, the act of a son sort of trying to reimagine himself back into their relationship, but also realizing that's impossible. It's if it sounds subtle, it's because he is just the most subtle, philosophically kind of, I think, interesting, but also he resists cliche, he resists sentimentality at all
Very
points.
I mean, he's had some exceptionally good reviews so far, and one of the things that people, as you mentioned, have praised about this writing for his parents, the way it's a fantastic portrait of them, basically, that he's created. But I'm curious about it. Sort of, people have also picked up on the fact that it's a bit of a snapshot of sort of 1930s to 1950s America in a certain sense. And I wondered, what sort of picture does he paint of that era almost?
He's very good at the sort of, again, the broad, very, very sort of delicate kind of portraits of what life was like. I mean, it starts with a wonderful scene. His father was a traveling salesman. It starts with a wonderful scene. They live in Jackson in Mississippi, of his father coming through the door carrying amazing kind of food, Louisiana food, and laying it out on the table. And you get the sense of a kind of a 1950s kitchen and a sort of the precise detail of what his father was wearing, the smell of his father's soap. So you do through the kind of the specific imagery that I guess is his memory, you do get a kind of a social history as well, and a sort of a change in the attitudes. The stepfather of his mother is a kind of a rackety character, but at the same time, his father's a terrible scene at the end of his father's life, where his father's body is kind of kidnapped back to by his parents back to the cemetery in Arkansas where they come from, and his mother feels she's been doubly bereaved. Not only has she lost her husband, so you get this kind of the sense of America, 20th century America, emerging out of this kind of rural swamp and becoming kind of sophisticated.
And yet, despite that sort of swampiness, it sounds extremely precise as well, in that sort of very Ford-like way. It sounds brilliant, John, I must say.
As far as, the parental memoir, I mean, Blake Morrison wrote a wonderful one. There have been lots of them. Michael Ondaatje is running in the family. It's right up there. I mean, I'm a huge Richard Ford fan, but I think this is a small, perfect masterpiece. And if you're even remotely interested in, just in the way how language can transform the most fundamental things, the relationship between a parent and child, it's just a beautiful book.
John, you've whetted my appetite, definitely with that description of that mid-century dining table as well. That sounds great. Between Them, Remembering My Parents by Richard Ford is out now, published by Bloomsbury in the UK and Echo Press in the United States. Let's move on now to the new novel by poet and writer Megan Hunter. The End We Start From is her widely acclaimed debut, and it only hit the bookshelves yesterday. John, set up the storyline a bit for us in this one.
It's, in a way, it's a very simple storyline. It's a woman who is expecting a baby. The baby is born, and then it's written in a very, very terse, again, very beautifully constructed. It's very, very short, small paragraphs, so that the detail is built up very carefully. But it becomes clear that the baby is being born into a world which is London, and that London is in the middle of a kind of an environmental crisis, in the middle of a flood, London. And the book really then takes off into the relationship between the mother, unnamed mother, and the child, who we know out throughout is Zed, and the partner, the husband, who is R, and they escape out of London. But it soon becomes obvious that the country has gone into complete kind of, civil emergency lockdown. People are being rounded up and put into camps. There are checkpoints, the strip searching. It's not quite, as sort of rich and complex in its detail as Cormac McCarthy's The Road, but in its emotional impact, because at the core there is the most vulnerable thing you can imagine, which is a small newborn baby, against this kind of...
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, one thing that struck me, you mentioned that The Road there, famously an incredibly bleak read, anyone who has delved into that one. But I wanted to ask you one thing. We've seen in the last few months this phenomenal spike in sales of dystopian fiction, especially since the arrival of Mr. Trump into the White House. But there sounds like, when I was leafing through this, there sounds actually like it's not all complete gloom. There's some sort of baseline of hope contained in this, as you mentioned, despite the rounding up of people into camps and this phenomenal environmental disaster that everyone's trying to survive in. There's actually some positives here.
What I think she does really, really brilliantly is the idea that once you start to lose the external flim-flam of your life, you are forced to confront the fundamentals. And one of the lovely things she does, she threads through the narrative quotes from creation myths from all over, obviously the myth of the flood. So you're continually having, it's almost, the book is written in a way that you read it, it's more like reading a sort of a, as it were, Alain de Botton-style meditation.
It's written in these short vignettes, yeah, almost, isn't it?
She's obviously, she's a poet, and the language has got great weight and precision. But you get the sense that it's what's not said is as important as what's said. But there is a hopefulness in it. And I think part of it is that it's one of the most, yes, there's a sort of a sense of dread and sinister kind of, as there always is in dystopian fiction. But the portrait of a mother and her baby at the core of it, and the developing and the relationship between, that is the kind of, the hope in the end is that the child, and I won't give away the ending, but the child doesn't die. Mm. So that's one spoiler. But just a little sentence just gives you a sort of sense of how she manages it. Yesterday, like today, I had a full stomach. My breasts were hard or soft, a kind of clock of their own. Now, without internet, without phone reception, there is this. The filling, the emptying, the lumpiness of an engorged breast, the tingling of its release, there is this. And that thisness but what you get is this sense of, yeah, this is kind of, when you strip everything else away, if everything all does really go tits up, we will still have this, we will still have that connection between a mother and its child.
Do you know, on a slightly different level, in terms of that terseness, that even which was in that short passage that you read then, that sort of directness of the language and that kind of clarity almost, and these short vignettes, it really reminded me of Agota Christoph's The Notebook in a way almost. Obviously much more bleak and much more disastrous in tone, yeah, is The Notebook, but it did remind me of that. Now, it's just been announced that they're going to turn this potentially into a film. The film rights have been sold to Benedict Cumberbatch's company, Sonny March. How can they turn a text like this into a film?
I don't know. I mean, I'm pleased. I'm delighted for Megan Hunter, because I think, yeah, I mean, it's a really,
for a debut, as
really
well,
great debut. And I think it's a huge credit to Picador here for having spotted it and publishing it beautifully, I think. I don't know. I mean, there's a story. There's a story, and I guess, you know, that's what you'd have to. But, you know, the terrible truth about the, I think it was Joyce or somebody who said this thing about the modality of the visible. With film, you can't hide anything. You can't have, it's all in front of you. So you have to kind of, you have to make it all join together.
You can't do the bit, you can't do the bits that no one can read.
I mean,
read
unless
on,
you're maybe Tarkovsky or Bergman. But well, good luck, maybe. I mean, I can't say that I think there's a story there which people will enjoy. It reminded me a little bit, there's a wonderful writer, Sarah Hall, who did a book called The Cahullan Army a few years back, which was another dystopian about a woman on the run. I mean, I think there is, as you say, there's a lot of fiction that is dystopian now, and why not, given the world we live in? But I think this stands out from there's a core, it's a book about mothers and children as much as it is about dystopia.
Well, hope in a time of dystopia. I think we could all do a little bit of that, couldn't we? John Mitchison, thank you very much. And he was talking there about The End We Start From by Megan Hunter, which is out now, published by Picador. John and Kathleen are going to stick around until the end of the show, when Fernando Augusto Pacheco will join us for this week's Global Countdown. But we're going to nip now over the Irish Sea. A new movie, The Journey, tells how the leaders of the warring tribes of unionists and nationalists in Northern Ireland risk the wrath of their followers to rescue a faltering peace process. It's a narrative that should appeal to audiences at home and abroad. But as Ian Wiley reports from Belfast, the movie's struggle to get a theatrical release, despite a highly regarded cast, experienced producer and film festival plaudits, demonstrates the increasing difficulty in bringing independent films to a cinema screen near you.
Do I recognise you from somewhere?
This is Dr. Ian Paisley, leader of the Democratic Unionist Party.
And this is Martin McGuinness of the Irish Republican Army.
Two old enemies at the back of a car.
Cool.
It's a chamber piece movie that neatly summarises how dialogue trumps division. But while feted at Venice and Toronto film festivals last year, The Journey has only just reached cinema screens, despite its timely message for a world that in the 2 years since the movie was shot has found a fresh appetite for nationalism, division and borders.
We're here because we are on the verge of something the wider world will applaud, but our own people will hate. You are being asked to betray your tribe, and I'm being asked to betray mine. That's all.
The movie brings together two of the Northern Irish conflict's biggest characters and enemies. Ian Paisley, a firebrand preacher and leader of the Democratic Unionists, who want Northern Ireland to remain a part of the United Kingdom, and the late Martin McGuinness, former IRA chief and the leader of Sinn Féin, who seek a united Ireland. Having never spoken a word to each other, the pair are forced to make a journey together. The unlikely friendship that ensues paves the way for the election of Paisley and McGuinness as Northern Ireland's First Minister and Deputy First Minister. The film's screenwriter is Colin Bateman, author of more than 35 paperback thrillers.
In reality, their first meeting happened on an aircraft, on a private jet. They got home from the talks. But that didn't really work for us, because you can't set it all on a private jet on a 20-minute flight. So we came up with the idea of setting it in the car to the airport. And what happened during that journey that turned them from being mortal enemies to the best of friends?
Within a few weeks of delivering the first draft of his script, Bateman was sitting in Liam Neeson's New York apartment as he read it to fellow Northern Irish actor Kenneth Branagh, though in the end the parts of Paisley and McGuinness were given to Timothy Spall and Colm Meaney.
We took it to the Venice Film Festival, and you know, and it's so rare for just a small movie to get into a big festival like that. And I think it was shown four times and standing ovations at the end of each performance. And something I'd never come across before, there was spontaneous applause during the movie in exactly the same place. Timothy Spall does a big set piece speech as Paisley. And when he finishes that speech, every time it's been shown, both in Venice and in Toronto, it was in the Toronto Film Festival as well, the audience burst into applause. And I'd never seen that before.
American critics at Venice loved it. A celebration, wrote Variety, by two splendid actors of the art of political theatre. But British critics, seeking perhaps a film that reflected these more pessimistic times, weren't so generous. Silly, odd couple of bromance fantasy, complained The Guardian.
I think in retrospect, it was bad. It was a bad idea to show it in a small room to a small number of people. The other screenings for critics in Venice were for cinemas with like 500 critics in it. And then you get the buzz of being with an audience, and you see the reaction of other people in it. And that's what cinema is, you know, it's a communal thing, you know, and a good feeling can quickly spread through an audience.
The views of the critics in the mainstream press still matter, says the film's producer, Mark Huffam, who also produced Saving Private Ryan, The Martian, and the first season of Game of Thrones, much of which is filmed in the forests, mountains and moorlands of Northern Ireland.
What it does do is, you know, when you get into that position, you know, the potential buyers in the UK are going, "Ooh, critics don't like this film. What do we do?" So it makes it difficult to make a sale of the film to a distributor in the UK. And it does. There's no point in saying otherwise. It makes it difficult.
The Journey finally reached UK cinema screens last week and will be released in the US in June. To get some understanding of why it's increasingly difficult for good movies to get a theatrical release, I called Mark Beatty, chief executive of the body that represents the people who sell movies on to cinema exhibitors, the Film Distributors Association.
One of the challenges is the sheer volume of films that come into the marketplace now. You know, if you look over roughly the last 10 years, UK cinema consumption has pretty much flatlined. It's round about 170 million admissions per annum. What's catapulted up is the sheer number of releases, which has gone up in the last sort of dozen years or so from 300 or 400 releases to literally 2016 was 900.
But given the various digital distribution options now available, such as Amazon, Netflix and others, is a cinematic release still essential?
It is clearly the way in which filmmakers want and hope and expect their films to be consumed. When they're looking through the viewfinder, it's a cinema screen they're seeing. It's not a tablet or a laptop or even a TV screen. Filmmakers want the immersive, shared, out-of-home theatrical experience for their movies, and that carries a lot of weight. And there's a business reason as well, in that a theatrical release still kickstarts the value chain.
Unless they're in the business of making superhero blockbusters, independent filmmakers may one day need to surrender their love of the big screen. For screenwriters, producers and directors, the idea of going straight to DVD or streaming may eventually lose its stigma. But it seems not yet.
Thanks to Ian Wiley for that report. Well, to end the show, as always, we have the global countdown. And not only that, we have, of course, Fernando Augusto Pacheco joining us here in the studio. He's going to talk about, as usual, the top five singles of a specific country. And it's a Lusophone nation. It's a little bit closer home, maybe not completely home, but not too far. Fernando? Yep.
Absolutely. And they won the Eurovision Song Contest as well.
Most certainly did.
In some ways, that's why I chose Portugal. Because I was there in Kiev covering the event for Monaco.
Brilliant.
And I was clapping very hard for him to win. And he did win, Salvador Sobral.
First time for Portugal to win, of course. So, Salvador Sobral took home the Eurovision trophy. But he's not in the top five, though, is he?
He's not in the top five, and I'll explain why. I mean, he's number eight this week, but I think the full effect of the sales post-Eurovision will be actually next week. So I wonder if that will make him for the top five, because I know he's got, like, sold-out concerts. I mean, he's a big star already in Portugal, and I think, the Eurovision win, it will be even more. But I was talking to a Portuguese colleague of ours, Carlota, and she said that it's not very common to have Portuguese artists in their top five. And I think it's kind of true. I'll give you the countdown in a bit. Especially the Portuguese, they love Latin American artists, you know, so you have a lot of kind of songs in Spanish, reggaeton, even songs from Angola sometimes.
Now,
but
Salvador
from Portugal, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, but Salvador's song, do you think that might have the, now it's got the Eurovision trophy, he's coming home victorious, do you think that might sort of rally the troops a little bit more? People listening to more Portuguese music?
I think so. Or perhaps people go and buy his album, because, you know, he's not a very catchy tune. I think he's like Adele. It's better you buy the album instead of a specific single in some ways.
Fernando, who's made that top five this week?
Let's do a little countdown here. And number five was a song I discovered today, actually. I didn't know that. It's Jason Derulo and Nicki Minaj and Ty Dolla $ign. The song's called Swalla. I mean, it's a very bright, colorful video with some nice beats there. You know, nothing against that. I think Jason Derulo is a great guy. He's done very decent pop tunes in the past, and it was a nice discovery. Number four, Enrique Iglesias. He might not be as big in the Anglo-Saxon world anymore. He used to, I think, a decade ago or so, something.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's still very popular in Portugal, the neighboring country. He has a song called Súbeme la Radio. And he's got, of course, a Cuban reggaeton artist there. His name is Decemer Bueno. And two guys from Puerto Rico called Zion and Lennox.
Mm.
So, again, I have to say, there'll be more Puerto Rico in this chart. But wait a second. number three from Norway, we have Kygo, the DJ that he almost created this tropical house beat. And he's got a very nice track with Selena Gomez, It and Me. Number two, I've been talking since I started the Global Countdown, is Ed Sheeran, Shape of You. You can't avoid Ed Sheeran, even in Portugal, of course. But shall we hear a clip of the number one song?
Yeah, let's do that. Fernando, I think you should announce what we've just listened to.
I will. It's Luis Fonsi from Puerto Rico and Daddy Yankee, Despacito. Well, before we talk about the song, Luis Fonsi is an interesting case because he's 39 years old. He's been well known in Latin America, in Spain, in Portugal as well. But I think with this song, he became a huge star. I've checked his website. He's got like sold out concerts all over Europe and South America as well. And well, before I talk what this song is meaning to the world, I have to say, what did you guys think of it?
Is he Puerto Rican?
He's Puerto Rican.
What? Tell me, Fernando, why Puerto Rican? Because there's two artists here in Portugal. Why are they popular in Portugal right now?
I think because in Puerto Rico, it's like a machine of producing reggaeton artists,
right,
which is a rhythm that, it's popular all across Latin America and even some parts of Europe as well. Even sometimes here in the UK, you hear something here and there. So for some reason, they are, may I say, the Swedish of Latin America in a way.
That's right.
Because because it's a small country that makes incredible, you know, music and artists.
Reggaeton is a phenomenal kind of music because it can blend with so many. In Ghana, for instance, in West Africa, huge reggaeton scene there, but you know, blurring with the indigenous music styles and so on. Kathleen, I want to ask you: did you watch Eurovision? Were you on your sofa, checked them out, cheering for Portugal or otherwise?
I'm going to be shamed, but I didn't this year.
John, what about you?
I'm really ashamed to say I didn't, and I don't know, it seems to me to be the most brilliant anti-Brexit kind of tonic, Eurovision, right?
It's just absolutely,
and it's become a ritual, and I think that I know there's all the kind of mumblings that it's now impossible for Britain ever to win again, and I don't think anyone for a long time has ever watched the Eurovision with any hope that the usually hopeless British act is going to win it. It's the madness that comes from the fringes that's what I love.
And I have to say, it can always be worse than UK. Like, you can be Spain, for example. I'm sorry for the Spanish listeners, but I mean the last 2 years they were at the bottom of the list, and they had a very bad song this year as well. So I think it's actually a question of producing a nice pop tune.
Bad news for Spain, but quite good news for Portugal. Well, that brings us to the end of today's programme. This show was produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us at the same time again next week. But for now, let's hear the rest of that number one from Portugal. This is Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee with Despacito. Despacito. Quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído. Para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito. Quiero desnudarte a besos.